Imagine for a moment being entirely responsible for the main water supply of a whole city. Now picture that system, that crucial supply, having deficiencies. What does it truly take to fix something that vital? Today, we're taking a deep dive into the blueprint for just such a fix. It's a professional services agreement for the rehabilitation of the Shawnee Twin Lake #1 Dam in Oklahoma. And this isn't just, you know, any old document. It's the detailed roadmap for safeguarding a city's most fundamental resource. Our source material is the actual agreement itself, pages of technical legal language. Might seem a bit overwhelming at first glance, but you'll quickly discover it's packed with some surprising facts and real aha moments.
Exactly. Our mission today is to really pull out the most important bits of information from this agreement. We want to shed light on the critical steps, the responsibilities involved, you know, in making sure vital infrastructure like dams are safe and sound for the long haul. You'll see how this complex document is, well, much more than just paperwork. It's the definitive guide to a pretty monumental engineering and public safety project. #, the who, what, where of the agreement.
Okay, so to kick things off, when a city needs to fix something as critical as its main water dam, who are the key players they bring in? Who's involved?
Right. Well, the first thing you see is who they partner with. This agreement, formally, it's between the city of Shawnee, Oklahoma, and a specialist engineering firm, Fries & Nichols, Inc., FNI, they often call it.
FNI, okay.
And, you know, this isn't a DIY job. Bringing in FNI right away, it signals just how complex this is. It needs experts in modern dam safety and rehabilitation.
Makes sense. And what kind of financial commitment are we talking about here? Just for these initial services, right? Not even the actual construction yet.
Exactly. That's a key point. For just the professional services outlined in this first phase, the planning, the evaluation, the city is committing a lump sum fee of $262,000.
Wow.
Yeah. And that figure alone, it really underscores the significant upfront investment needed. The specialized expertise required just to plan the rehab of critical infrastructure, it highlights that, you know, even before a shovel hits the ground, serious resources go into thorough analysis.
So beyond the who and the price tag, what's the legal framework? How is this whole thing officially governed?
Legally speaking, this agreement is administered and interpreted under Oklahoma state law. And any legal proceedings, if they happen, have to be held specifically in Pottawatomie County.
Okay.
Now, a critical point here is that this document, it represents the entire understanding between the city and FNI. It legally supersedes any previous agreements written or spoken.
So this is the document?
This is it. Every detail in these pages is definitive. It's crucial. And we can also see it's pretty recent. It was finalized with signatures from FNI's Victor Vasquez on June 7th, 2024, and the city's Andrea Weckmuller-Barrender on June 20th, 2024.
Okay, let's dive into the really interesting part. The scope of services. This isn't just patching a leak, is it? What specific engineering services is FNI actually providing here? And why are they so essential?
You're absolutely right. It's far from simple patching. The project description itself clarifies that Shawnee Twin Lakes #1 and #2 are the primary public water supply for the city.
The main source?
The main source. So this initial scope, it directly targets deficiencies identified in previous studies and inspections, specifically on dam #1. It's really about proactive assessment and planning to keep that vital lifeline working.
So this agreement, this first one, it isn't for the whole construction job then. It's more like a diagnostic phase.
Planning. Precisely. That's a good way to put it. This first phase focuses specifically on engineering evaluations and recommendations.
Mm.
Future phases, things like additional studies, detailed designs, helping with bids and getting permits, maybe even overseeing construction. Those can be added later.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Through an amendment to this very contract, it shows they're taking a phased, really methodical approach to this complex problem.
That makes sense. Let's break down these initial basic services then.
Yeah.
First up is field inspection.
Mm?
What does that actually involve? It's more than just someone taking a walk around regularly.
Oh, definitely. It's incredibly thorough. FNI will conduct a single-day visual inspection, but it's done by a multidisciplinary team. These are people experienced specifically in Oklahoma dam safety. They'll meticulously check all the critical parts, the top, the slopes of the embankment, the spillway, the channel where water flows out, the abutments. Those are the natural banks the dam rests against.
Right.
And here's where modern tech comes in. They'll use a drone.
A drone.
Yeah, to visually inspect the upstream slope, you know, the water side from above, and also looking back at it from the reservoir itself. And they also plan to invite the Oklahoma Water Resources Board, the OWRB, to come along with their team.
So extra oversight.
Exactly. It brings another layer of expertise and oversight right from the start.
Okay. And then there are topographic surveys. We hear that term, but who's doing these and why are they so incredibly detailed? Sounds like a lot of measuring.
It is a lot. For this part, FNI is actually bringing in a sub-consultant, a company called CEC, Inc. It'll be building on previous survey info the city already has from 2021, but the detail is crucial because they're essentially creating this super precise 3D map of the whole area.
Like a digital twin.
Sort of, yeah. They'll survey the entire dam, #1 embankment, the area just downstream, the abutments, all detailed enough for 1-foot contour lines. That means showing elevation changes as small as 1 foot.
That's precise.
Very. They'll also locate exactly where the spillway crest is, the drop structure, and a good 600 feet of the channel downstream. Plus, mapping out utilities, guardrails, other structures, even parts of the other dam, the emergency spillway on Twin Lake Dam, #2. All this data, new and old, gets compiled into one big comprehensive site topographic model. It's like, as you said, giving the dam a complete digital checkup, an MRI.
That is a mountain of data. Okay, next up, document review. Why is digging through old papers so important for a modern dam project that's already using drones and fancy 3D mapping?
That's a great question. It's all about historical context, really, learning from the past. FNI will review basically all the available historical documents they can get their hands on from the OWRB, from the city related to the original design, the construction, any analyses or investigations, past inspections of dam #1.
So everything.
Pretty much everything they can find. They'll even review some documents for dam #2 if they're relevant to the overall water flow analysis. You absolutely need to know how it was built, what issues it might have had before, what fixes were tried. It all informs the new solutions. It's connecting the past to the present to secure the future.
Makes sense. Now, hydrologic and hydraulic studies, or H&H, that sounds specialized. What are the engineers trying to figure out here? Why does it matter so much?
H&H is fundamental. It's all about understanding how water behaves, how it flows, how the dam handles floods. FNI will perform updated flood routing analysis. Basically, they need to see if the dam, as it is now, can handle the kind of water flows required by the OWRB for what's classified as an intermediate high-hazard dam.
High-hazard, okay, that sounds serious.
It means failure could cause significant damage or loss of life downstream, so the standards are high. The analysis involves several steps. First, using publicly available LiDAR data.
That laser scanning tech.
Exactly. It creates really detailed 3D maps. They use that to define the watershed, all the land that drains water into the lake. Then they figure out how much rain to expect using the OWRB's online tool. From there, they build these sophisticated computer models, like one called HEC-HMS. It simulates how water flows into and through the whole reservoir system, including Lake #2's emergency spillway.
To see if the spillways can handle a massive flood.
Precisely. To check spillway adequacy. They'll also use another model, HEC-RS, but just for the channel connecting the two lakes to understand how that behaves during floods. This kind of H&H analysis is absolutely critical. It predicts how the dam will perform under extreme weather. Ultimately, it's about protecting the city downstream.
Okay, so after understanding the water flow, there's seepage and slope stability analysis. Why are these separate things, and what do they tell us about the dam's actual, like, structural health?
Think of these as checking the dam's internal health, its vital signs. They're critical for structural integrity. FNI will use data from a different report, a 2024 Terracon report, but they'll develop their own independent analysis parameters based on it. Then they run their own analysis using specialized engineering software.
More software?
Yep. CPW is for seepage analysis that studies how water might slowly leak or seep through the dam or its foundations. Not good if it's excessive. And SLOPW is for slope stability analysis. That checks if the dam's earth and slopes are strong enough, if they'll hold up and not, you know, slide or collapse.
Okay, stability is pretty key for a dam.
Absolutely crucial. And they analyze this under lots of different conditions. Normal, steady water flow. What happens if the lake level drops really fast, rapid drawdown, during an earthquake scenario and during flood conditions? All of this follows really strict guidelines from both the OWRB and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the USCEU.
It just raises the question. You mentioned how many scenarios they model. Mm. It's incredible the sheer number of things, potential disasters, engineers have to account for.
It really is. The complexity is immense, trying to model all those possibilities. It highlights the depth of expertise involved.
Definitely. And so, finally, all this incredibly detailed work, the inspections, surveys, reviews, modeling it, all comes together in the preliminary engineering report, or PER. what's actually in that report and who gets to see it.
Right. The PER is the big deliverable for this whole initial phase. It's the culmination of all that data gathering and analysis. It'll include all the results, findings from the field inspection, you know, observations, photos, maps, plus the results of their independent seepage and slope stability work, and the H&H analysis.
So all the findings.
All the findings, yes. But critically, it doesn't just state problems. It provides actionable recommendations. Things like ongoing monitoring needed, maybe suggestions for more investigations, and specific dam safety and maintenance repairs or full rehabilitations. It even includes budget-level cost estimates, ballpark figures, and conceptual drawings for the recommended fixes.
Conceptual, so not final blueprints yet.
Exactly, just initial ideas. And what's particularly interesting here is it also includes a peer review of that 2024 TerraCon report we mentioned.
Ah, so they're double-checking other work too.
Yes, adding another layer of expert validation. Now, a draft of this PER goes to the city for review. It's assumed it'll also be shared with the OWRB and potentially the USEE. There will be virtual meetings with the city and then a combined meeting with OWRB and USEE to discuss everything.
Lots of stakeholders involved.
Many. The final report incorporates all the comments received, and the idea, the intention, is that these recommendations will then move forward into final design through a future amendment to this contract. It's the roadmap for what comes next. #tag project timelines and responsibilities.
Okay, we've really dug into the what of this project, all that complex engineering. But let's switch gears a bit to the when. With such a comprehensive scope, what's the expected timeline? How long does F&I have to do all this initial work?
Well, the agreement is actually very specific about that. It includes a clear project schedule laid out in a table. The initial site inspection, that has to happen within 30 days of the notice to precede the NTP, the official start signal.
Pretty quick.
Yeah. Then the surveys and that big H&H evaluation, those are due within 120 days of the NTP. The draft PER, that main report, is expected within 180 days.
Okay, about 6 months for the draft.
Roughly. And then the final PER is due within 21 days after everyone, the city, OWRB, USCE, has resolved all their review comments on the draft. So it's a pretty structured timeline for a project this complex.
That sounds like a pretty tight schedule. What happens if things get delayed? Maybe waiting for approvals or something. Does F&I still have to hit those original deadlines no matter what?
Not necessarily. The agreement builds in some flexibility there. If F&I services get held up, and it's not their fault, maybe delays in getting reviews back from the city or the regulators, or even just delays getting necessary information or approvals, then F&I is entitled to adjust the schedule. Yeah, they can extend it basically by the number of days they were delayed, and those kinds of delays might also lead to an adjustment in their payment. It protects them from holdups outside their control.
Right, that makes sense. So F&I has its tasks and timelines, but what about the city of Shawnee? What are their specific responsibilities to make sure this huge project actually moves forward smoothly?
Good question. The city has several key responsibilities outlined to ensure success. First, they have to designate an official representative in writing, someone with contract authority to give instructions and clarify policies. In this case, it's Seth Barkheimer, PE.
Okay, a point person.
Exactly. Second, they have to help F&I by providing all the relevant project info they have, including those previous reports we talked about. And crucially, the city is responsible for arranging access for F&I to do its work, access to both public and private property. You can imagine trying to survey land if you don't have permission to be there.
Yeah, that could stop things fast.
Absolutely. And finally, the city must carefully review all the studies, reports, and documents F&I gives them. They need to get their own legal or other professional advice if needed, and then make decisions in writing promptly so they don't hold up F&I's work. It really highlights how collaborative these big projects have to be. It's a true partnership, not just hiring someone to do a job.
So we've covered the engineering deep dive, the timeline, but let's circle back to the agreement itself, the legal nuts and bolts. What are some of the critical legal and financial terms that really define this relationship between the city and F&I?
Well, a really fundamental piece is something called the standard of care. It's in term three. F&I basically commits to doing all the professional services with the professional skill and care ordinarily provided by competent members of the subject profession practicing under the same or similar circumstances.
Okay, so basically do the job like any good engineer would.
That's the essence of it. But what's really important here is what follows. The agreement explicitly states that F&I makes no warranties, express or implied.
No guarantees.
No guarantees on the outcome beyond providing that standard professional level of service. It emphasizes that engineering is about applying expertise and best practices, you know, using professional judgment. It's not like buying a product with a warranty because there are just too many variables they don't control.
Right. Let's talk money. Compensation and payment, term 7. How does that actually work? How does F&I get paid, and what happens if payments are late?
Okay, so F&I can ask for progress payments, usually not more than once a month, based on how much work they've completed. Payment is due within 30 days after the city receives and accepts F&I's invoice.
Standard 30 days.
Yeah, just standard. Now, if the city doesn't pay within that 30-day window, the amount owed starts increasing at a rate of 1% per month, like a late fee.
Okay, an incentive to pay on time.
Definitely. And furthermore, F&I can, after giving the city 7 days written notice, actually suspend their services until all the overdue amounts are paid in full.
They can stop working.
They can pause work, yes. They're also entitled to potentially get more compensation if their work gets delayed or suspended by the city, or if the project gets extended for more than 60 days for reasons outside their control. It's a framework designed to keep the project moving and ensure fair payment.
Now, F&I also provides these opinions of probable construction costs, term 6. Does that mean they're essentially guaranteeing what the final construction price tag will be?
That's a really important distinction to make. The answer is no. The agreement is very explicit. F&I does not guarantee the accuracy of such estimates.
Okay, so they're just estimates. Educated guesses.
Educated guesses based on their extensive experience and qualifications, yes. But they don't control things like the actual cost of labor down the road or materials or equipment. They don't control market conditions or how different contractors decide to price their goods.
Right. Lots of variables.
Exactly. So this is a crucial point for any public works project like this. Engineers give their best professional judgment for planning and budgeting, but the real world factors in construction mean the final cost can always be different from those early estimates. It helps manage expectations, especially with public money.
Makes sense. Yeah. What about ownership? All those detailed documents F&I produces, the drawings, the reports, all that data, who actually owns that stuff? Term 8.
Good question. All those drawings, reports, data, everything F&I develops for the project, it becomes the property of the city. However, that's only upon payment of F&I's fees.
Nah, once they're paid.
Once they're paid. F&I is allowed to keep copies for their own records, though. But here's another key point. Those documents are not considered suitable for reuse by the city or anyone else on, say, a different project without F&I verifying them or adapting them in writing first.
So you can't just take the plans and use them somewhere else?
Not without F&I's input. Any reuse like that, without their sign-off, is entirely at the city's own risk, and F&I has no liability. Interestingly, F&I can reuse the general knowledge or non-site-specific parts in their other work, but that's at their own risk. It's really about protecting the specific design work and its context.
Okay, got it. Finally, let's touch on limitations on F&I's liability. It seems like the agreement is pretty careful about defining what they are not responsible for. Terms 10, 12, 15 look relevant here.
Absolutely. These contracts always include clear lines defining responsibility. It's standard practice. For instance, under construction representation, term 10, if F&I is involved during construction, their role is generally to observe the work's progress and quality. They check if it seems to align with the design documents, and they report any problems they see. But, and this is crucial, it's explicitly stated that F&I does not guarantee the contractor's performance.
So they don't manage the builder.
Exactly. They don't supervise the contractor's day-to-day operations. They're not responsible for how the contractor builds things, their methods, techniques, sequences, or safety procedures. Nor are they responsible for mistakes made by anyone other than their own team. What really stands out here is that very clear separation of roles and responsibilities between the design engineer and the construction contractor. They do different jobs.
Okay. What about environmental stuff like pollutants? Term 12.
Right. Regarding pollutants and hazardous wastes, F&I basically states they didn't create or contribute to any existing hazardous conditions at the site, and their fee isn't calculated to cover the risk of dealing with that stuff. They don't take possession or control of the site itself, and they aren't responsible for managing any existing pollutants found there or during cleanup. It clearly defines the boundaries of their environmental responsibility.
And lastly, consequential damages. Term 15. That sounds important.
Very important and very standard in professional service contracts. F&I is explicitly not liable for any special, indirect, incidental, or consequential damages.
What does that mean in plain English?
It means things like loss of product, loss of use of the dam or water, loss of profits or revenue for the city, or increased operating expenses that might somehow result from the project or the agreement.
So indirect financial losses.
Exactly. F&I's liability is generally limited to the direct aspects of their services, not these broader knock-on financial impacts. It's a significant clause that limits their financial exposure on large, complex projects where indirect consequences could potentially be huge. Hashtag tech tech outro.
So after all that, what does this really mean for you, our listener?
We've just navigated quite a deep dive into what might, you know, at first glance seem like a pretty dry legal document. But I think we've seen it's actually a meticulously detailed blueprint. It's the plan for ensuring something absolutely critical, like a city's main water supply dam, stays safe and functional. It really is. It's a testament, I think, to the hidden layers of complexity involved. It's not just about engineers looking at a dam. It's about this rigorously crafted agreement that defines every responsibility, outlines really sophisticated engineering analyses like, remember the seepage and slope stability stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It sets clear timelines, establishes precise legal frameworks. It pulls together everything from old historical documents to cutting edge tech like drones and LIDAR and these complex computer simulations for floods. This document really shows the immense amount of thought that goes into keeping essential services running.
Yeah, absolutely. So here's maybe a final thought for you to mull over. How often do we actually stop and consider the sheer amount of unseen work? All the specialized expertise, the careful, intricate contractual agreements like this one that go into safeguarding something as fundamental as, well, your daily glass of water. This deep dive, I hope, really shows those hidden layers, the planning, the science, the legal frameworks that protect our most vital resources, working to ensure they stand strong for, well, for generations to come.